Welcome back, friends. Dr. Ken Berry, family physician, here with you this afternoon, evening. I'm going to be hanging out for the next hour or so, chatting with a good friend, Cynthia Thurlow, who is a nurse practitioner, an advanced practice nurse with 20 years of clinical experience in cardiology and other specialties. We're going to be talking about the new non-nutritive sweetener study, where they looked at stevia and many other sweeteners and how they affect the glycemic response, gut bacteria, and other very interesting things. We're also going to be talking about some intermittent fasting tips. Cynthia has made quite the study of intermittent fasting and has a book about it. And I'm going to bring her up. If you have questions for us, please ask them in the comments. And we'll try to answer as many questions along the way as we go. Let me see if Cynthia is ready. I think she's ready.
Yes. Hi, Ken. How are you?
Hi. Good to see you again. Thanks for doing this.
Absolutely. This is real. I've been really looking forward to this because I know our communities, there's a lot of cross overlap and a lot of interest in just getting good information out there and continuing to improve the quality of everyone's metabolic health.
Absolutely. I think anytime the message you're getting out there is a useful message that's easy to apply, that has pretty immediate results, people are pretty darn interested in that. The average doctor thinks their patients don't care about nutrition and wouldn't follow any kind of nutrition plan if you gave it to them. So they just prescribe some pills. But you and I have both discovered quite pleasantly that if you give people information that actually works.
You know, to me, I feel like in many ways, a lot of the work that I do now is a direct reflection of the misinformation that I unknowingly was giving my patients. You know, I started as an ER nurse and then spent 16 years in cardiology. And the information I used to share with patients almost makes me shudder. And so that's why I'm so committed for the second half of my lifetime that I'm going to do everything I can to help educate people about metabolic health and doing the things that can make us more insulin sensitive as opposed to insulin resistant. And it's really a public health crisis. I think that you and I and a lot of our colleagues that are speaking out about this are helping to change the narrative. And I think that's so valuable, but there's a lot of work to do. I always say for every, you know, 5 to 10 people I meet who are very aligned in terms of their methodology and their principles, there are twice as many. I won't call this individual out on social media, but I had a little bit of a tussle on Instagram. I had a female cardiologist try to suggest that I was dangerous because I was suggesting that glucometers and continuous glucose monitors were a way to empower our patients. And this individual, who I'm sure you know who I'm talking about, really came out with the boxing gloves on. And I was shocked because I try very hard, as I'm sure you do as well. I'm not looking to provoke an argument with anyone. But it was very clear this individual's agenda was completely different. And the following week, this individual talked about an alignment with a new drug to help reduce blood sugar. So is it any wonder she doesn't want you to understand your body's response to stress and nutrition and sleep and exercise? She doesn't want you to be empowered. We do.
Yeah, exactly. And working in the clinical setting, You, I'm sure, and I, because I know I have many times bumped up against someone's cognitive dissonance, where the truth is literally slapping them about the head and neck, but they cannot see it at that moment. And this vegan plant-based cardiologist you're speaking of, I would call her name because here on this channel we speak the plain truth. And what it is, but I can't remember her damn name.
I think it's Danielle something.
Danielle DiBellardo or yes. Bellardo, something like that. But yeah, she literally said people don't need to know what their blood sugar does after a meal. And that they're also, I think she intimated that there was a CGM shortage and you'd be mm-hmm. keeping these from diabetics who need them. And it's like, what are you talking about? You sound ignorant right now. And I think she's a very intelligent lady, mm-hmm. Board certified cardiologist, a fervent believer in plant-based diet. And the problem with a plant-based diet is that if you eat that and you wear a CGM, you see very quickly that your blood sugar is spiking after each and every meal to the point where you are definitely causing an unhealthy amount of glycation in your cells and tissues. And so, yeah, if I were advocating a plant-based diet, I would not want you to wear a CGM either.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, to me, one of the greatest disservices that we have done as a medical community is not having sufficient education about nutrition. And a lot of the education we received is a byproduct of subsidized agriculture. It's a byproduct of government organizations that have an agenda. So MyPlate is a great example. In fact, I was asked probably 5 years ago to speak at my children's elementary school about nutrition. And I had to pull the teachers aside and I said, I don't advocate for MyPlate. And so we had to figure out how we could have a conversation about food and educate the children, but explain, okay, no, Mrs. Thurlow actually really is going to talk to you about more protein, healthy fats, less carbohydrate. And the kids' minds were blown. There were no complaints. None of the parents complained, but it was very hard to, whether it's cognitive dissonance, people are like, oh, heart healthy grains. And I'm like, no, do you realize that actually the grains that you're talking about are the things that are given to cattle prior to going to slaughter, or animals going to slaughter, because it fattens them up. So encouraging people to eat copious amounts of grains and at very little protein and the wrong types of fats is hugely impactful on our health, and not in the ways that we want it to be. I think we've gotten so accustomed to seeing people who are very sick that when we see photos, like I know I was looking at a photo from 1970 and I put it on Twitter. And of course I got one person who got horribly triggered. And I said, listen, I'm just telling you, it's as stark a realization as it is for me that there, everyone in that photo was thin. And you see photos of people now, and that is not the case. You're an outlier if you're healthy. That's one of the things, you know, when I was in Salt Lake with you speaking at Keto Salt Lake, and my husband said every single speaker looked really healthy. And he said, how often do I go to business events? And it's not the case. He said, but, you know, people in this community really endeavor to be the example they can be for their patients or for anyone. And so, you know, getting back to the original where this conversation was going, I think that we have to accept that most conventional wisdom as it pertains to nutrition is dangerous. And if you want to be healthy and you want to be an outlier, you need to do the complete opposite of what they're recommending. Because, you know, even my kids know this. We talk about how we eat very differently than their peers do. And it doesn't have to be that way. And it's not to suggest that this hasn't been a full circle for me as well. You know, I used to be that person that was, God, it makes me laugh. I would go to the gym. I'd have a protein shake going to the gym. I'd have a protein shake after. I'd have a snack mid-morning. I'd have my lunch if I was lucky. I'd have a snack in the afternoon. I was doing all those things. And it was what I was telling my patients. Oh, you just need to exercise more and eat less. That'll get you to weight maintenance. And you realize now you were telling patients the wrong thing for years and years.
Yeah. And that's exactly why I've said this before. I started doing this was to try to atone for the egregious nutrition advice that I used to give my patients who were obese and type 2 diabetic, had fatty liver, metabolic syndrome, hypertension. I would say, you need to join the gym and join Weight Watchers. That was my standard advice. And for the first 6 or 7 years of my practice, I worked regularly as an ER physician. And so I have great respect for you as a ER nurse. When I was a brand new resident physician and moonlighting in the ER, a wise older resident said to me, listen to your nurse. Always listen to your nurse and always be respectful. And I was like, I think that's like pissing off the cook, right? You don't want to do that right before dinner. And so Rosemary says, what's the CGM? And I think a lot of people maybe have this. This is a continuous glucose monitor that goes right here. It will check your interstitial blood sugar every 5 minutes. There's an app on your phone. And what the reason that a CGM is so powerful is that it dispels a lot of the false health choices. Like a lot of doctors will say, well, don't eat white bread, eat brown bread, whole grain bread. But if you're wearing a CGM, Cynthia, you're like, it really was no difference there. You know, don't eat Lucky Charms, eat Honey Nut Cheerios, because that's heart healthy. But then if you're wearing your CGM, you're like, what the hell? I get the same spike with both of those, white rice, brown rice, white potato, sweet potato. If you're wearing a CGM, Rosemary, all of a sudden, all the bullshit that sounds like, oh, okay, brown rice, not white rice. Okay, it's a different color. That must be magical. But if you've got that CGM on, you're like, no. So you stop eating the Lucky Charms and start eating a bowl of steel-cut oatmeal that took you 3 days to cook on the stove. And you watch the CGM, and you're like, there's that blood sugar spike again. I thought oatmeal was good for me. So that's what a CGM is, Rosemary. I hope that helps. Now, there's a new study out about sweeteners, because everybody watching this right now, all 2,500 of us, we know that sugar is going to spike our blood sugar, spike our insulin. We know that honey, agave nectar, brown sugar, organic cane juice, that's a great euphemism they love to use for sugar. Evaporated grape juice, that's just sugar. We know that spikes our blood sugar and therefore spikes our insulin, but a lot of us have trusted stevia, sucralose, monk fruit extract, and these sorts of things. And there's a new study that I was hoping that you could talk about a little bit that kind of looks at this, not in the detail that I would have liked. I've got a couple of problems with the study. That's why I didn't make a YouTube video about it, because I feel like the way they did the study muddied the water to the point where I can't give anybody a takeaway message from this. What did you glean from this study?
Well, I think it's a great point that we're constantly looking for sugar substitutes, right? Like, I know the standard question we get is, does it break my fast? You know, I have a CGM on or a glucometer, my blood sugar didn't go up, so it's not bad. And I just remind people that whether it's stevia, sucralose, aspartame, monk fruit, thiocyanate, it is still sugar, or it's a sugar-like substance. It is still hitting dopamine hits in our brain. It is still, you know, getting that cephalic phase insulin response geared up, because your body thinks something sweet is coming. And my biggest takeaway, because everyone thinks of stevia as being 100% benign, and, you know, my biggest takeaway was, holy cow, people are still testing with saccharin. I mean, I think from like the 1970s, my grandmother drank Tab. And I'm dating both of us by saying, like, that was my last recollection of saccharin. But how many medications have sucralose in them? Tons.
Yep.
It's not benign. I think that when we look at the net impact from this study of just the impact of saccharin and sucralose, it impacted oral glucose tolerance tests. And so for anyone that's listening, this is that terrible test that you take where you have to drink very, very sweet. It's almost like taking orange cane syrup sugar and you're forced to drink it. And those of us who've been pregnant, we've been stuck doing that. But it's the syrupy sweetness. And so it's getting a sense of how high of an impact or how much of an impact this glucose load has on your blood sugar. And actually, the sucralose had some of the worst impact. But secondary to that is the impact on the gut microbiome. And, you know, for everyone that's listening, like, oh, what does that mean? Well, the gut microbiome, we learn more and more about it every year, and there's more study and research coming out. But this is where the bulk of our immune system is. This is where we make healthy neurotransmitters like GABA and serotonin and many others. This is, you know, the net impact of whether or not we have a leaky gut. I mean, there's so many things that go on. And so my big takeaway when I looked at this was, there are some limitations in this study, but it goes to show people that these sugar-like substances, whether they're fake sugars, stevia, et cetera, they're not benign. And so I think that when we start keep looking, I feel like the keto community, the low carb community, every community is always looking for a fix. You know, I've found in some of the big keto products, they have sucralose. And so I literally have been at events where I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, I've got a dairy allergy. Or I've just tried to politely say, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to use that. But if you look at this right here, saccharin and sucralose had the most net impact on blood sugar response. So even within a 28 day period of time, you're seeing that there's this profound net impact on your insulin sensitivity. There's this impact on the gut microbiome in negative ways. But we know that when we stopped utilizing these sugars, these non-nutritive sugars, that blood glucose response improved, insulin sensitivity improved. But it just goes to show, you don't have to use these things for a long period of time to have a net impact on your blood sugar. And so, yeah, sucralose in particular, it's interesting. I was treated last year for mold, and I was given a cholestyramine, and they gave me the option of flavored or unflavored. And I said, well, I don't really want flavored anything. And so I had to take this binder, and every time I took it, I kept thinking, what is this doing to my gut microbiome? Because it was sucralose that was in there. And it can, you know, create dysbiosis, which is this byproduct of having, I always say it's like having weeds in the garden, non-beneficial bacteria. And we know that we're at risk for that anyway, as we're getting older. But the big takeaway for me was, even looking at these quote unquote benign sugars, they're not benign. And so we really need to make an effort to eradicate and eliminate and limit our consumption of sugar. That's really what I took away from it, is that they're not benign. Obviously, this was a fairly short study, but I think the results of this, to me, were very convincing of why we want to be mindful about our consumption of sugar. And I think stevia is one of those non-nutritive sweeteners that everyone thinks is totally benign. People say it's keto. I always think of you, Dr. Barry, when I'm thinking about, you know, Lily's dark chocolate, and you're looking at net versus total carbs. And I remember you saying, like, net carbs is a cheat. So it's one of those things I teach my coaches and my patients. I'm like, listen, you don't want to cheat, because you're only cheating yourself. You know, the food manufacturers love exactly chasing the sweet taste, just to keep us wanting it more. You get a dopamine hit in your brain. It feels good. And people want more and more and more. So that was my big takeaway, just to help educate people about the fact that, you know, these non-nutritive sweeteners are not benign. And unfortunately, they're in a lot of conventional medications and things that, you know, you probably don't even think about. I mean, I cringe when I think about the fact I used to have a big thing of sucralose that I used to bake with, because I was like, oh, this is so much better than regular sugar, not realizing now that ultimately it just makes us less metabolically flexible. And that's a negative thing.
No, I totally agree. And let's be very clear. And I'm going to talk about a couple of problems I have with this study, but I still think it's an enlightening study. So for everybody freaking out right now about that, we're bad mouthing stevia. Hear me. I still believe, I firmly, truly believe that stevia is less bad than sugar. I think monk fruit extract is less bad than sugar. Splenda, however, I don't think is less bad, because it actually has sugar in it. It has maltodextrin and glucose. They call it dextrose, which is funny that they would call it that in the U.S., because that's what you would call it in the U.K., right? Not here. We call it glucose. But they knew that everybody would know what that meant. So they put dextrose, because that kind of sounds like Dexter, like the right hand, like that's powerful. But that's just sugar. And so definitely Splenda's out. That's crap. But the sucralose, the stevia, even aspartame, if you're coming from a standard American diet and you're converting to a low carb, to keto, to ketovore, then I think it's absolutely a useful tool in the interim. I am not anti Diet Coke or Diet Pepsi, Diet Dr. Pepper during that transition phase. First, stop drinking the damn Coke. If you need Diet Coke to do that, that's fine. Then after a few months with the Diet Coke, you can start to cut your Diet Coke half and half with a sparkling water that has no sweetener whatsoever. I promise you won't be able to tell the difference. And then keep using more water and less Diet Coke until you're just drinking, God forbid, just drinking water, like we've done for the last, ever since we've been on this planet, however long that turns out to be. But the one problem I have with this study is they used glucose as the vehicle for all the different sweeteners. And so they put a little sugar with each of the different non-sugar sweeteners. And it's like, of all the vehicles that you could have possibly used on the planet, why would you put a little sugar in with each of the sweeteners? And indeed, when you look at the glycemic response, just the glucose vehicle got less of a glycemic response. The other thing I wish they had done is I wish that they had tracked the insulin spike. Mm-hmm. I would have loved to have seen graphs. And Professor Ben Bickman and I have talked about this multiple times. I'm begging and pleading with Dr. Ben Bickman, please grab a bunch of your graduate students and do an insulin spike study with these different sweeteners without glucose as the vehicle. And I would love to see what happens to someone's insulin response 30 minutes after a sucralose load and a stevia load and a monk fruit. I would love to see that, because there is this thing in human physiology called the cephalic phase insulin response. When you taste something sweet in your mouth, your insulin goes up by definition. It's like a physiological principle, almost a law. And so you're going to get some degree of insulin elevation when you put something sweet in your mouth. And actually, the cephalic phase insulin response is so hardwired to other senses that probably just looking at the hot fudge cake or smelling the freshly baked cake, that's going to raise your insulin. And watching a television commercial about your favorite breakfast cereal, that probably raises your insulin. And so a lot of people, this freaks them out. It's like information overload, and I totally get that. And I don't want to be guilty of doing that. But at the same time, if you're going to go down this road, I want you to at least understand some of the basic principles of the science. Don't you think that's important, Cynthia?
I do. And it's funny. I have, I think the world of Ben Bickman myself. I know he's working on a new book. I haven't been able to get it out of him what he's working on specifically, but I would love to see the insulin response. And I now say to my patients and anyone that is willing to listen, you need to know your fasting insulin response. How many patients have I cared for? I'm sure you have as well. Their fasting glucose isn't too bad. Their hemoglobin A1C isn't too bad. You find that their fasting insulin is 20. Yep. Like, well, I know why you're not losing weight. And so, you know, it again goes back to the CGMs and glucometers and really empowering our patients, because I have a woman who actually started doing a program with me, and she was pre-diabetic and obese and menopausal and just, you know, really frustrated. And within six weeks of eating lower carbohydrate and changing her diet and eating less often, just those couple of things, her fasting insulin came down into a normal range. She was no longer pre-diabetic. She lost the weight. She was off her blood pressure meds. And isn't it a beautiful thing when we can empower our patients to have control, as opposed to, I felt like in many years when I was in cardiology, the motivation factor, I would have patients that would say, Cynthia, I really like you, but I'm not going to stop smoking. I'm not going to change my diet. I'm not going to change my lifestyle. I'm not willing to stop drinking alcohol. I'm not going to do any of those things. So just give me the pill. I always found that so frustrating, because we've conditioned our patients to ask for a pill as the amelioration of a symptom, when really it's a lifestyle problem that they
will. And I think we have trained patients in more ways than one. And one of the greatest ways that a doctor can train a patient to think that diet is irrelevant, just give me the pill, is to give them idiotic nutrition advice. And so when I used to tell people, join Weight Watchers, oh, that didn't work for you, we'll try Jenny Craig. Oh, that didn't work for you, well, just move more and eat less, right? And so they had actually tried all those things that I recommended back in 2003, 2004, and failed miserably, not because they're losers, but because that shit don't work. It's stupid.
It's not sustainable.
Right. And so then when I say, oh, there's this new, you know, this new keto diet or whatever, they're like, yeah, just give me the pill, because they have motivation fatigue, because they've literally tried every damn diet that's come up on social media, everything their neighbors tried. They've tried all that stuff. None of it works. And because it's the wrong advice. And so when something comes along that does work, a lot of people have this fatigue. They're like, I'm sick of it. Just give me the pill. And yeah. I think Big Pharma's playing into that perfectly with some recent new additions to the type 2 diabetes treatment space that can also lead to significant weight loss. I think they're playing into that because they know people are sick and tired of trying all these stupid different diets, because there's only a few that actually work and that are actually nutrient dense and actually sustainable.
Are you referring to Saxenda? So the injectable drug that I get messages about that all the time.
Yeah.
And what I found from patients who've had it prescribed by other providers, many of them have lost a tremendous amount of weight, but what do they gain? They're totally bloated and constipated.
Yep.
And I say, well, do you understand that it slows gut motility? And then you're constipated. Like for me, the threat of constipation alone would be one reason why I would say there's just no way I'm doing that, because I would be so uncomfortable. But it's interesting that now on like the black market, my colleagues are telling me that this goes for thousands and thousands of dollars, because people are so desperate. Like they want the next big thing because they're so fearful that they can't master the lifestyle changes effectively. Sorry, the doodles are agreeing with us. But it's fascinating to me that not only is pharma trying to, you know, corner the market on this, they obviously don't want people, you know, utilizing nutrition and lifestyle strategies as a way to lose weight. They want us dependent on quick fixes. And isn't that that's recreating this, you know, cycle of abuse that people don't even have full disclosure when they're taking these medications, not realizing like, oh, it really isn't your blood pressure is the issue. It's that you're insulin resistant, and you fix the insulin resistance and the blood pressure and the triglycerides and the HDL and your PCOS and your infertility. I mean, all these other things, you get this amazing trend of, you know, being much more aligned with the way our bodies are designed to thrive and not just survive.
Yeah, I totally agree. Everybody watching, we got 3,300 watching. I need you to do three things for me, and then I'm going to give you a good nugget of knowledge that will help you greatly to understand your metabolic health. Please hit the thumbs up. Please tell me in the comments where you're watching from, what city, what state, what country, so I can see where everybody's at. And if this is your first time you've ever caught one of my lives, type new in the comments. I want to see how many new people I've got. Now, everybody listening, listen carefully. It doesn't really matter what your blood sugar is from minute to minute, okay? What really matters for fat storage, for fat burning, for overall metabolic health, for blood pressure, for triglycerides, for all that, is what is your insulin level? So many doctors will check a fasting glucose. They'll check an A1C. But they do not either don't know or won't check a C-peptide and a fasting insulin. Everybody get a pen and paper and write those two tests down. And if your doctor says, oh, no, you're fine metabolically, I don't know why you can't lose weight, tell your doctor to order a fasting insulin and a C-peptide. And even if you're injecting insulin currently, the C-peptide will still tell you the tale, okay? You need to do both of these fasting if possible. Otherwise, they're going to give you much less information. But those two tests alone can predict type 2 diabetes 10 years before your A1C starts to elevate. Have you seen this, Cynthia, in your practice?
I have, and it's interesting. So back when I was a baby nurse practitioner, so probably around 2000, 2001, I was hanging out with some postdocs that were from Australia. And one of the things that they would like love to give me unsolicited opinions about as clinicians, they're like, hey, you know, we're the MD, PhDs, we're researchers. I just want you to know y'all suck with the way you manage diabetes. And so they said, why aren't you checking a fasting? And I just recall years and years and years ago that they were talking about the fact that we manage diabetes so poorly in this country. They said, you wait till people get disease. And that is exactly what we do. I hate sharing this, but one of my best friends from high school, who I had suspected probably was insulin resistant, I've been asking her for 2 years. I was like, ask your doctor for fasting insulin. It's like $12. It is so inexpensive. And so she finally did. And he had been telling her, oh, you don't have diabetes. You don't have diabetes. Well, her fasting insulin was 16. And so all of a sudden he was willing to do the continuous glucose monitor. He was willing to, you know, have her do lifestyle motivations first and fasting and other things. And she said, why didn't you let me do this 10 years ago? Like, why were you fighting me all the way along?
He didn't know. That's why. Because he didn't know what the hell fasting insulin even meant. Mm-hmm. And many doctors will tell patients that. They'll say, I wouldn't even know what to do with the results. And if a doctor tells you that about fasting insulin or C-peptide, that's a huge red flag. You need to find another doctor, my friend.
Yes.
That's what that means, because they don't know the first damn thing about metabolic health. If they don't know what a fasting insulin test, what information that gives them.
And I think it's important for everyone to understand, like I jokingly say metabolic health is wealth. And I tried to corner that phrase, but too many of us are talking about it, which is fine. But I think it's important to understand that our health is currency. And the more that we can do to ensure that we are living vibrant, healthy lives, irrespective of what age range we're in, the better off we are. Like the one thing I think many people don't realize is that we actually get epigenetic changes. So if you take really good care of yourself, you're going to pass along healthier genes to your offspring. And it's not to suggest that if your parents weren't healthy, that you can't be. That's not what I'm saying. But it's important to understand that there's actual like changes that go on at a cellular level. And so when we're talking about metabolic health, we're really talking about the mitochondria, really talking about these powerhouses of our cells. And one of the ways that you can really prime that pump is with intermittent fasting and, you know, eating a ketogenic, you know, low carbohydrate diet. And I would actually argue that most people probably have to really redefine their lifestyles. Like it's very easy to find keto junk food and vegan junk food and there isn't carnivore junk food that I'm aware of, but I'm sure for every methodology or nutritional dogma, there's probably a paleo junk food. It's all out there. But ultimately, it comes down to the less processed food you're eating, the less cravings you'll have, the more stable your blood sugar will be. It really is that simple. But it's getting from the noise of the standard American diet and eating these hyper-palatable, highly processed foods, getting to a point where you can stabilize your blood sugar, and then you're open to the possibility of, okay, I can lean into fasting. It's not so scary. I can now still have my, I can still have butter on my vegetables. I can still add salt to my food. And, you know, salt's no longer the boogeyman. We realize how important electrolytes are. And so my mea culpa for the rest of my life will be apologizing for a lot of the misinformation, but now we know better. And that's really what it's about, helping people understand the science and understand, you know, real world applicability. It's one of the things I really value about your voice in the space, is that you're a realist. You're not rigid and dogmatic, which I think there are other people in the space that can be that way. And I think it can be very off-putting, because you come from a place of service. That's really, we go into medicine because we are heart-centered and we want to help people. And the way to help people is to meet them where they are.
I totally agree. And I'm not trying to impress people. And I think some people in this space are trying to sound really scientific and use those $14 words, as my grandfather used to say. And it's like, I'm not here to impress you. I'm here to help you. That's what I'm here to help you understand. I'm here to help you build a mental paradigm so that basically you're foolproof. You can't be tricked. And so when Kellogg's comes out with their new keto Cheerios, right? I think that's General Mills, but whatever. Well, there's going to be a keto cereal that's coming, and there's some in the small space, but I'm talking about Kellogg's General Mills Post. One of those guys is going to come out with a keto cereal. And I want people to understand the principles of a proper human diet. Because when you understand the principles about what we're talking about, you're going to be like, that's bullshit. There's no way that processed cereal from a factory with 82 ingredients, there's no way that's keto. There's no way. That's impossible. That's an oxymoron. That's what I try to do, is help people build a framework in their head. So you just can't trick them. They're just not going to fall for the stupid shit that the big corporations are going to be telling. I think back to the pharmaceutical we were talking about, Saxenda. And there's a couple of more that the drug reps, every time they come to the doctor, they're like, you know, we've had a lot of patients lose a lot of weight with this. And people ask me all the time about these drugs. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, smoking crack will help you lose a lot of weight as well. But there will be side effects and repercussions. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly the same story when it comes to Saxenda and all these other Ozempic's another one, where it's like, it's going to lower your A1C 0.5 of a percentage point, right? And you might lose some weight, but I'm not going to tell you about all the side effects that you're going to experience.
Yeah, and I think it's important. You know, I, as a nurse practitioner, I worked in a very busy cardiology practice, and part of my job was translating science and medicalese and making the information accessible. Because let's be honest, some of our peers, you know, they're very ego driven. And so they walk in a room and they lay a bunch of big fancy words out there, and the patient's like, I don't know what they just said. And so a lot of my job was interpreting complicated concepts and explaining it to patients and making sure they understood it. And I think on a lot of levels, we overcomplicate our messages. You know, I recall when I was writing my book, I kept saying to my editor, like, I'm really struggling because I do know a lot more than what's in the book. And she said, no one expects you to write a science text. You're not a researcher. You're not writing a scientific journal. Just explain it in a way that it makes the information accessible. And, you know, if we can do that at the end of the day, that's a gift. That really is a gift. I can honestly say that I get the opportunity to see a lot of people speak on stages, and you in particular do a wonderful job of just taking the science and taking the information and making it accessible, because then it changes lives. That impact is unbelievably important and so very vital and so important. And I would argue that the role that you and I and others have in this space is really to take information and allow it to be actionable. That's the other thing. And you know, wherever people are in time and space. So if they're transitioning from being a couch potato and eating a standard American diet, that's okay. We've got a plan for that. Or if you are someone that is super type A and you want to go 100% in, all in for everything and be really rigid and dogmatic, we can work with that, but I always encourage people not to be that way. And somewhere in between are most other individuals, but it's giving people grace and, you know, allowing them to kind of find their way. I think I love now that I'm seeing in the space that we're seeing more, you know, you're seeing keto carnivore come together. You're seeing some people, they're maybe doing plant-based for a period of time, maybe to clean things up. And then they transition into consuming animal products again. And so I find it's a beautiful thing that we have some variety in what we're doing. You know, some things may serve us for a period of time and then we may need to pivot and try something else.
Yeah, exactly. Alyssa. Yeah. I didn't put a link in the show notes to the study, but as soon as this live is over, I will correct that error. I'll put a link to the study. The study was peer reviewed and it was published in a quite prestigious journal. And let's sum up again, Cynthia, if you don't mind the study, because I've seen a few questions in the chat about what was the results. And so basically this study tested stevia, sucralose, lots of different sweeteners. And what they found, I'm going to let Cynthia tell you.
Yeah. So when they were looking at saccharin, which as I was joking about before, I don't know anyone who's using that.
Please.
1970s. So sucralose had a larger net impact than stevia or aspartame on glucose tolerance. So net impact on your blood sugar control, as well as the gut microbiome. What I found interesting, as I was mentioning earlier, is that they did this study over, you know, it was like tested at 7 days, 14 days, 28 days. So fairly short. But one of the big takeaways I took from it was when they stopped the non-nutritive sweeteners, that the blood sugar response improved, the gut microbiome response improved. They did some fecal transplants with mice, which I always say, I love when they use animal models, but I always say, you know, mice are not humans, but it gives you some helpful information. So my big takeaway that I was sharing with my coaches is that, you know, we talked about cephalic phase insulin response. So just in response, having something sweet on your tongue, that alone can evoke an insulin response. And obviously that was the limitation of this study, that it didn't look at that. But in terms of the most adverse impact, it was saccharin and sucralose, and then it was stevia and aspartame. And I was saying that, you know, as an example, there are a lot of medications that have these non-nutritive sweeteners in them. So they're not benign. And really have to be thinking, what would the long-term impact be? Is this someone that would go from being pre-diabetic to diabetic with chronic use? Would this be someone who went from being insulin sensitive to being pre-diabetic to diabetic? And so that's the thing that I keep thinking about, is we like to convince people they're benign. Sugars are not benign. These are no different than those sugars. The other thing that I thought about was, we don't know what type of stevia they were using. I know when I've really looked at the research, you know, when people are doing organic extract, the stevia is probably very different than a Truvia product, which is Coca-Cola's variation of crystallized stevia. I'm not sure what they used, and that remains to be seen. But I know that for me, I thought this was convincing enough to, you know, want to share this study and to talk about it, because there's a lot in there that's valuable.
Yeah. And to be very clear, neither of us are saying that stevia or any of the other non-caloric sweeteners are bad, but we're saying they're not as good as just not using any sweeteners at all. They are probably less bad than just using sugar, table sugar. They're probably less bad than that, but they do have an effect on your blood sugar. They do have an effect on your serum insulin level, and they do have an effect on your gut bacteria, which, as you may or may not know, is very important. We don't even know how important it is. If anybody tells you they've got gut bacteria, the microbiome figured out, you can hit the unfollow button right there. Because literally, currently, the state of the art is we don't know shit about shit. Literally. Yeah. And so one day I think we will know, oh man, it's hugely impactful if you affect your gut microbiome. That's a big damn deal. You don't want to do that, at least in a negative way. And all these sweeteners had an impact on the gut bacteria in the participants in the study. And it wasn't a very long study, but I think it was a start. But definitely, I think a better study could be done and needs to be done in the near future. I see behind you a cover photo of your new book. Tell us about this book.
Well, this is the first book written by a woman about women and fasting. And so one of the things that I've come to find, I always say fasting found me. I didn't find fasting, unknowingly, when I did a talk 3 years ago that became very popular. this is really the spurn of this. There, that when I did the second talk, they asked me to do a female slanted conversation. And through, you know, the last 4 or 5 years, I've really come to understand that women at different stages of their life need to fast differently. And so a lot of this book is talking about some of the science that's been done. Most of it's been done on rodents, animal models, and men and postmenopausal obese women. So there's a lot more research that needs to be done, but really highlighting how women at each stage of their life can embrace this methodology and this strategy. And I think in a lot of levels, after working with thousands and thousands of women, it is a strategy that most, if not all women, even if you get to the point where you just don't eat for 12 hours, I would say that's the bare minimum. Like, everyone should really, unless you have a reason otherwise that you've been instructed by your doctor, your healthcare provider, really not eating for 12 hours has tremendous benefits. And obviously with my cardiology background, a lot of the issues that I saw could have been improved or fixed just by eating less frequently. So the book really dives into the science, makes it very accessible, speaks at great length about, you know, women that are at peak fertile years, you know, 35 and under, versus perimenopause 10 to 15 years before menopause, and then menopause 12 months without a cycle, how we have to fast differently depending on where we are. And it was written really to be empowering, because there wasn't information solely focused on fasting for women. There was always this extrapolation that it's a one size fits all. If it works for men, it must work for the same way as women. And there was also a lot of fear mongering. It was amazing when I was doing a lot of research on, you know, well-meaning health influencers out there that were acting like the boogeymen. And I said, if this was not a healthy strategy for women, we wouldn't be here as a species, because there was plenty of years of food scarcity. And the only way that we could get through years of not having food, or periods of time without food, was that our body intrinsically knew it would go in and break down fatty acids and utilize that as a fuel source. So I'm very proud of the book. It's done really, really well. And obviously the support of my medical peers has been really appreciated, and very, very grateful for that.
Excellent. I've got a copy, and I think it's an excellent book for people who are like just starting with fasting. And so everybody watching this, you fast every day for the 6, 7, 8 hours you sleep at night. You're actually dry fasting, aren't you? Right. And so we know that fasting is not dangerous by definition, because you do it for 8 hours every night. So what if you just added 2 hours to the beginning of your sleep and 2 hours to the end? That's now a 12-hour fast. As Cynthia was saying, every human on the planet should be fasting for a minimum of 12 hours every day. And so wake up, wait 2 hours before you eat, stop eating 2 hours before you go to bed. That's a 12-hour fast, right? And once you've gotten used to that, and as you slowly are lowering the carbohydrates, because it's very, very hard to fast on a high carbohydrate diet. It's almost impossible for most people. But as you continue to eat fewer carbohydrates, it'll effortlessly go to a 13-hour fast. And then you'll start skipping breakfast altogether. Then it's going to be a 16-hour fast. And it's easy. But I recommend, and I want your opinion on this, I recommend people start with the diet. Start with the food. Your diet. Lower the carbohydrate intake. And after you've done that, then the fasting will kind of come on its own. Have you seen any benefit to trying to start the fasting first? Or do you think that you should lower the carb first and get the diet proper? Either bring the dog on or put the dog in the closet.
Usually they're slugs and they're quiet, but they just decided tonight that they want to bark at the neighbor walking by with this child, which is ridiculous. I usually say, you know, the Band-Aid comes off when you stop snacking first, and then we readjust macros. And that's where we start. And then we kind of go to this methodology of going from dinner to breakfast without eating. So we really do it slowly. And I agree with you that we have to start with nutrition first. I find for a lot of people, the concept, if the average American's consuming 300 grams of carbs, I'm tongue-tied, 200 to 300 grams of carbohydrates every day, you can imagine saying to someone, I want you to eat under 100 grams of carbs. I mean, they're like, I can't do that. And I would say, yes, you can, but we're going to start with no snacking. Then we move on to restructuring your macros. And once we start pushing the protein piece, or if they're eating a fattier cut of meat or a fatty fish, their appetite should start to regulate itself. And encouraging people to eat more vegetables. I mean, I'm a huge fan of non-starchy vegetables, but I find that that's the stepping stone. And then we go to 12 hours without eating, and empowering people and saying, listen, if you go from 6 o'clock at night to 7 o'clock in the morning without eating, I promise you, you're going to feel good. And so that with trepidation, because we've conditioned our patients like, oh, have snacks and alcohol and, you know, whatever you do before bed and, oh, it's to stabilize your blood sugar. And I'm like, that's BS. You need to eat a really nutrient dense dinner, which will help stabilize your blood sugar, which will allow you not to wake up in the middle of the night, which you'll get up in the morning and you'll feel good. But I agree with you 100%. You have to start with nutrition first, and you have to convince people that they can really do it, because if they're satiated from breakfast to lunch and lunch and dinner, then they're like, okay, I think I can do this. And so it's really those small steps, because we want things to be sustainable. I say all the time, there's no white knuckling it. I'm not a fan of people that I see on social media. They're like, I had a miserable fast today. And I'm like, then break your fast early. There's no like fasting police that are going to come arrest you because you didn't fast for 16 hours. My gosh, maybe you fast for 13, maybe you fast for 14. I think there's too much rigidity. And that's one thing that I think for it, for women in particular, depending on where they are life stage, can be a problem.
Do you find that most people do better skipping breakfast or skipping dinner?
I think if you look at, you know, the research on chronobiology and you're looking at the research on insulin sensitivity, I think from what I know, we're much more insulin sensitive during the day. So my standard refrain in spring and summer is eat when it's light outside, don't eat when it's dark outside. I think it really depends on the individual. I was never a breakfast food eater. My Italian mother would try to force me to eat breakfast. And so I think that there's this natural inclination. People might wait several hours to eat, and they might eat at 10 or 11 a.m., break their fast then, and then maybe they eat dinner. But I think if you're really looking at the insulin-sensitive individual, they can choose. But for most insulin-resistant individuals, I would encourage them to eat earlier in the day so they have more time to, you know, take a walk after a meal. I think empowering our patients to understand there are ways around meals. So go for a walk for 10 minutes. You know, monitoring your blood sugar response is certainly important. I usually encourage earlier breaking the fast than later, but I think a lot of that depends on lifestyle too.
Here's $5 asked earlier. If we thought that eating red meat caused cancer or colon problems or heart disease, a lot of people, especially our plant-based cardiologist friend, Dr. Bilardo, will say, yes, it absolutely does. This has been proven. What do you say about the red meat is bad for some body part arguments?
I generally think most of that's disproven. I am good friends with Dr. Gabrielle Lyon, and we've gone through the studies together, and she's in the midst of writing a book. And so I think this is aligned with cherry picking of data. If you really look, if you get into the science, saturated fat per se is not a bad thing. If you're looking at nutrient density, if you're looking at, you know, protein macro breakdown. I find if you really look at the research, heart disease is created by inflammation, oxidative stress, insulin resistance, which is driven by eating too many carbohydrates, the wrong types of fats. I almost said healthy fats, and not enough protein. So based on my own research, I think, you know, eating an animal-based diet, you don't need to be afraid of saturated fat, especially not red meat. If your preference is you prefer chicken or poultry or fish, I think that's fine. You might have to eat a larger quantity to hit the same protein macros, but I believe a lot of that's largely been disproven. And if you really dig into the research, one of the things I always say is, who sponsored the research? That's number one. And number two, did they cherry pick it? Because I think the average consumer, and this is not a criticism, it's just an observation, doesn't know how to read the basic components of good research. And therefore, when the media picks up one snippet from a study, and then it's become law. You know, it's like the conventional wisdom. I think for so many people, they've been hearing for so long that these nutrient dense whole foods, organ meats, et cetera, are, you know, devoid of benefits. I think it's become like urban legend. So a lot of it's this reframing and the degree of cognitive dissonance people are experiencing, but we're starting to turn the tide, I think, for sure.
No, I think you're totally right. Cynthia Thurlow, thank you so much for doing this with me this afternoon. Please tell everybody again about your book and where they can find you on social media.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being in front of your community. So probably easiest to catch me on my website. It's my name, www.cynthiathurlow.com. You can get access to the book where it's at most major retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc. I've had Dr. Barry as a guest on my podcast, Everyday Wellness Podcast, twice. And I also co-host the Intermittent Fasting Podcast with Melanie Avalon. But I'm very active on Instagram. I'm a little snarky on Twitter. I sometimes get in trouble there. And I also have a free Facebook group called the Intermittent Fasting Lifestyle, which there are men and women that are in that group. We'd love for you to be part of it. And let me know if there's any questions I can help answer.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for doing this. Everybody check out Intermittent Fasting Transformation by Cynthia Thurlow. I don't think you'll be disappointed. Thanks so much, Cynthia. Go and pet your dogs and have a good evening.
Thank you, too.